Good morning. Nice to see you all. It's a pleasure to have the opportunity to come before you this morning and teach God's Word. Thankful to Brian for the opportunity, although he's not here. He's out enjoying himself with his family. Hope they're having a great time. Now, one thing, an issue I always have whenever I'm asked to sub for a class is I wish Brian would just go ahead and say, here, teach this. I would love to just be assigned a passage and just, okay, don't even have to worry about it. I'm going to teach this. But no, teach whatever you want. Oh, great. And what am I going to go for? I can't bring myself to just teach something completely unrelated to the purpose of the class. But at the same time, I can't just go on to Deuteronomy 11 and step on his toes and teach right in front of him. So I got this burden of trying to find something that is both informative, helpful, constructive with what you're doing in the class, and also not teaching what he's about to teach. So what I came up with, and I think this will hopefully work out as kind of just a helpful little lesson for us, is we're going to take a look at the book of Ruth, but we're going to look at it from the perspective of how Ruth makes more sense in light of Deuteronomy. In other words, there are things in Ruth that you really would have no idea what's going on with, without Deuteronomy, in some cases, the rest of the law. And beyond Ruth, you'll actually find the more you know the law, the more you know Deuteronomy and the other five books, the more the rest of the books make sense. How there is just so much throughout Scripture that is informed, and you really find the base, almost the root of it all begins in those first five books. And so I want to do this as a hope to give you kind of more motivation in this study of Deuteronomy, more encouragement as to why Brian is doing this study and teaching you through Deuteronomy, so you can even see how that is going to illuminate and inform your study of the rest of the Bible as we take a look at Ruth. Now, I'm really hoping that everyone here is at least familiar with the story of Ruth, because I don't plan on necessarily hitting every detail, but we're just kind of jump around to the parts that are most informed by Deuteronomy here. If anyone is not familiar with the book, let me know and I'll try to kind of fill in the details as we go. But here's a little roadmap of where we're going to go, just so you're aware, because otherwise, you know, I'm going to jump around, and if you're not paying attention, I might suddenly start talking about something totally different, and you get confused. So here's where we're going and what we're going to discuss. The first section, we're going to take a look at really just the setting of the book of Ruth, and how that is influenced by what God has talked about in Deuteronomy, and his blessings and his curses, and how that influences the underlying setting and the time and period in which the book of Ruth takes place. Secondly, we're going to take a look at this idea of gleaning fields. Ruth goes out in the field and she gleans. And it's like, what is that? It's not something we're familiar with today, but it is talked about in the book of Deuteronomy, lo and behold. And so we're going to look at that briefly. And we're also going to look at this idea of a kinsman redeemer, really an idea that's so kind of central to the message of Ruth when we look at Boaz and what his role and responsibilities were. So we're going to take a look at that. And, of course, that is also talked about in both Deuteronomy and Leviticus. And lastly, this one maybe some of you are less familiar with, but we're going to look at the fact that Ruth is a Moabite woman, and the book is very forward that she is from Moabite, from Moab. And if we know our Pentateuch, if we know Deuteronomy, we know that that was a forbidden union for the people of Israel. And so we're going to take a look at how even knowing what was talked about in Deuteronomy informs us to even realize that there is a tension in this book. The fact that she is a Moabite woman creates a tension for the reader as far as what is going on. And if you're not aware of that, you kind of miss a whole part of the book of Ruth that was intended, I believe, to teach and inform us. And with that, we will jump in and begin taking a look at our setting for the book of Ruth. Now, if you open up to chapter 1, you'll see in just verse 1, "Now it happened in the days when the judges judged." So this brings us to the book of Judges, right? That is kind of the period that Ruth is in. This is before, you know, obviously there is no kingdom yet, but this is after Joshua and his whole conquest. And what do we know about the period of the judges? What really seems to be the overarching theme of that book? Absolutely. That is a repeated statement. They did what was right in their eyes, for there was no king, is also stated along with that. So everyone did his own thing. So you have, on one hand, this moral ambiguity, and on this other hand, in that period, you have this kind of looking forward to a potential need for a king. A king, which, of course, in the book of Deuteronomy, Moses had already precursor informed was going to happen. There would be a king at some point. And if you know Deuteronomy, you know that's coming. And if you know Judges, then you know this is a period in which the people are awaiting and needing a king, but a right king, to help sort things out. But what else is going on? Because they are doing everything that is right in their own eyes, what is the result of that? Yes, yes, continual covenant disobedience. And as a result of the covenant disobedience, what happens? Divine judgments, yes, all over again. And it's just a cycle. Divine judgment, and then the people cry out, he rescues them, and they go right back to what they're doing, divine judgment. And as it goes through, it gets progressively worse. Each judge who rescues them is kind of worse than the last judge, until finally you get to Samson, who doesn't even seem to be concerned at all with the people. He just happens to accidentally rescue the nation during his own pursuits and his own pleasures. And so that's the background for Ruth. The nation is continually cycling in disobedience, and they are being judged by God for it. And we see these judgments. I think we've already gone through some of the blessings and curses in our study of Deuteronomy. And we can see the connection here to what God was going to be doing when they disobeyed and what we're actually going to see happens right at the beginning of the book of Ruth. I guess we haven't gotten to these curses yet, but chapter 11 is coming next, so we'll be here shortly. But if we look at these three curses, these are not the only curses that God pronounces against the people for their disobedience. Again, he gives them blessings if they obey, curses if they disobey. These are three that we see immediately in the first chapter of Ruth, which inform us that what is going on here is the people have been disobedient, and so therefore God is putting these curses upon them. The first one, Deuteronomy 11:17. And the anger of Yahweh will be kindled against you, and he will shut up the heavens so that there be no rain, and ground will not yield its fruit. And you'll perish quickly from the good land. And what do we have right here? There's a famine in the land in Ruth. And so right here we have echoes of that divine judgment. Not only do we know this is in the period of the judges where that divine judgment was on cycling, but right here they're in the middle of a famine. God had promised his people that if they were obedient, there would be no famine. That was a promise. So there could not have been a famine if the people had been acting obediently to the covenant. They were breaking the covenant. And so therefore, there's a famine. Secondly, cursed shall be the offspring of your body and the produce of your ground. So infertility. That was going to be another curse that the people would undergo. And we have that right here. When, and I apologize, I'm not going to read all the passages. I've got a lot listed here, and if I read them all, that would probably take up the entire time. So I'm hoping you're familiar with the story here. But when they go into Moab, Elimelech, he brings his family, takes them down to Moab. Instead of trusting God in Israel to provide, he takes them to Moab to hopefully find food in that land. He dies. And then his two sons, they decide to take wives from the Moabite women, and they have no children, and then they die. And so there's this infertility is another part of the curse that we now see here, even laid out against these two sons of Elimelech. And then lastly, Yahweh says it's part of the curse that he will have pestilence cling to you, will strike you with consumption, with fever, inflammation. Basically, he'll kill you. It's going to lead to early premature death for violating my covenant. And both Elimelech, Chilion, Mahlon, they all die prematurely in the story. And so knowing Deuteronomy, knowing just the simple structure that God gave Israel for the blessings and the cursings, we can see that this is clearly the effect of a curse that is going out against the people. But what is really kind of amazing about the story is knowing that even in spite of the fact that God is here cursing the land and punishing his people for their disobedience, in the midst of it, he's also, in a sense, working out their salvation. He never exercises his judgment, his discipline, without also having a glimmer of grace and hope in it. And that's what we see here. Now, just as a side point real quick, there are some thoughts that we have to have as we look at God's judgment here, as particularly on Elimelech, as he's killed and his sons die. And we have to think, so can we retrospectively say that, you know, he was killed because he was a sinner? Is that the nature of the covenant, that each and every person who disobeys God, God is going to promptly execute punishment in this way? Or was this simply a national discipline going on and he was just kind of an innocent guy who kind of got caught up in it and as part of it? I would argue probably neither or quite sum up the reality. We know in Deuteronomy that with the blessings and the curses, that was given on a national level. It wasn't an individual thing. It wasn't that each individual who does this is going to experience it. Because we know the reality is very different. There are often periods where the wicked would get away with their crimes and their sins for a period. Even the psalmist in Psalm 73, this is his lament, that the wicked are getting away with all their, they're having peace, they're prospering, they're doing well. And they're not having the problems of other mankind. So then we got to ask, so what about Elimelech? Was he simply innocent? Or was he also guilty? And the danger here is that we would look too closely at the retrospect, that we'd think, okay, because someone's been judged, something bad is happening in their life, they must have sinned. And that would be an error. That would be an incorrect way of thinking. We have the book of Job, more than any book, explains to us that just because unfortunate things happen does not necessarily mean it's a result of sin. However, in the case of Elimelech and his sons, we do see hints in the narrative that they were not a faithful remnant, that they were not faithful to God throughout this plague and this judgment. In particular, we have the fact that with Elimelech, when the plague hits, he does not trust God in the land, but instead takes his family to Moab, a country which is not in God's law thought of very highly and have been opponents of Israel and even oppress them at times. And so then he dies. But then we have the two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, and we got to wonder, are they guilty or were they innocent? And the narrative says that they took for themselves Moabite women, Moabite wives, which, again, indicates that they probably were not too concerned with God's law and obeying it. And so how we need to think about this is not necessarily that God struck them down individually for their sins, but when God judged the land as he promised, he would save and redeem the righteous, of which they were not. They were not among those who trusted in God. But we do see Naomi in the midst of all this. And Naomi is an exception. And if we looked at Naomi's situation, and we looked at it in the sense of, well, bad things are happening, she must be a sinner, we'd be very incorrect in that view. Naomi, her life kind of falls apart here. Her husband dies, her two sons die, she's left with nothing. But we, knowing the whole narrative, we can clearly see that God is going to bless her and take care of her and provide for her. And so it would be wrong to simply look at a person's situation and assume because they're in this situation, that must be God's blessing or that God's cursing on them individually. And even Jesus speaks against this very directly in Luke 13, verses 1 through 5. People ask him, you know, about the Galileans whose blood was mixed with the sacrifice, or those who were crushed by the Tower of Siloam when it fell. And he said, do you think they were more evil and that's why that happened? You think that's what was going on? No, that's not what was going on. They were not more evil. But what you need to realize is you are simply being spared at this moment, and you likewise deserve the same punishment they did. And so we look at the covenant God made with Israel, and he did promise these curses and these blessings for the nation as a whole, but we don't. That does not mean that we always see it play out in an individual level in an immediate basis like we'd expect. Sometimes the good and the righteous suffer affliction, and that's according to God's intentions. As if we're going to see that work out in this story, it's for a purpose, and it's going to produce more glory and be more wonderful than if they had not gone through that affliction. And sometimes God lets the wicked escape their judgment for a time. But that does not mean that they will ultimately escape it. And so when we look at the world, and we see the righteous being afflicted, having difficulty, and we see the wicked prospering, we can still remember God is in control, and he has things working out for good, just as they are going to work out in this book for us here. And as we, like I said earlier, anytime God shows judgment, there's always grace mixed in. From the flood, Sodom, Gomorrah, Canaan, when he comes in, he's in, saves Rahab. Every time there's a judgment of God, there's always a bit of grace and salvation through it. And we get that all the way up to where, of course, Christ, God judges Christ to save us. There's always this grace and salvation alongside of his judgment. We always see those things paired. And we see it right here now so crystal clear in the book of Ruth that God is exercising his judgment on the land and on the people. But through it, he is providing his grace. And we're going to see his grace in his redemption of Naomi and Ruth, and in a sense through his future redemption of the nation of Israel by providing the lineage for the king, for a true king, which ultimately is to the salvation of all of us through the line of that king, which will bring rise to the Messiah, Jesus Christ. And all of that grace is coming through a judgment. Which is just one of the beautiful pictures that we see repeating itself throughout Scripture, particularly throughout the Old Testament, and that we have here. But if you didn't know Deuteronomy, if you didn't know the curses and the blessings, you might just happen to recognize, well, that's a really unfortunate turn of events. You know, that's just, well, yeah, famines happen. They happen all the time. Well, not when God promises specifically to a land that it will not happen if they are obedient and that it would only happen as a result of a curse. But you can't know that if you don't know God's covenant with Israel and what he had told them beforehand. Not go there quite yet. Now, if we think about Naomi, she's someone a lot of us can relate to. You know, she got into this situation now where suddenly she is left bereft. She has no sons to take care of her. She has no husband to take care of her. And really, this had nothing to do with her own. This was not of her making. She had nothing to do with the decision to go with Moab. That was Elimelech. The grammar is very specific that he moved them there. And she had nothing to do with her sons marrying Moabite women. It specifically says they took for themselves Moabite wives. She, in a sense, is an innocent party to everything, and yet she is now suffering as a result and is in this hardship. And as many of us could be in a similar situation, it can be hard to see how God is going to rescue us through that, how we can have faith that God is going to somehow redeem that situation for our good and the good of others. But this book is an encouragement for all those in that situation who have gone through and experienced this kind of hardship and loss, that God is using it for his glory. He is using it for your good. And even if it's an ultimate eternal good, it is for that purpose, and he can accomplish it. New Testament parallel for us here. Of course, Paul tells us that there is nothing, but in all these things we overwhelmingly conquer through him who loved us. For I am convinced that neither death nor life, nor angels nor rulers, nor things present nor things to come, nor powers, nor height nor depth, nor any created thing will be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus. There's no situation that is beyond his love, his ability to save, and to redeem the situation for his good. And so we have that message in Ruth, understanding Deuteronomy, and we have it again repeated to us in another way in Romans. But it's really the same lesson all the way through. All right, we're going to try to keep moving here. So the next idea in Ruth that maybe we may not be fully informed without an understanding of the law and of Deuteronomy, is this idea of gleaning fields. So we know that, if we're familiar with the book of Ruth, that after the sons die, Naomi decides to head back into the land of Judah, that God has returned and is giving bread to the people and feeding them once again, and the famine has subsided. And so she is returning. Ruth and Orpah decide to go with her. She tells them not to, and Orpah leaves, but Ruth clings tightly and goes with her nonetheless. Now, being in this situation that she is in, we got to remember how different the culture was back then. There was no 401k. There was no retirement plans. Basically, every able adult's retirement plan was children. That's what you needed. You know, you're going to hit a point where you are not physically able to provide food for yourself, and you needed children to keep you alive. There was no way around that. If you did not have children who loved you, who would provide for you, then you had to appeal to other near relatives to hopefully get some mercy, because this was an agrarian society. They lived off of planting, harvest, farming. That was all essential for just their daily needs, to have bread, to have grain. And also remember at this time that the vast majority of labor was invested in food production. You know, here in the United States, I think maybe less than 1% of our total labor force time is involved in food, growing food, farming food. We're so detached from it because we've gotten so efficient with it. But in this day, all the work was primarily to get food. Some people had other jobs, but everyone had to work in some way to grow and produce food to live. And so because of that, because of the difficulty, because of the need for hardship, this is why life could be so hard for a widow, and that without protection. And in Deuteronomy, God consistently repeats his love and his concern for the sojourner, the widow, and the orphan, those who did not have the means to provide for themselves. Now, the sojourner, obviously someone traveling, they didn't have a place to grow. They had to kind of appeal at times to the help of others. And, of course, the orphan and the widow did not have even the legal means to provide for themselves with a field and with farming, and they needed to be taken care of. So in the Old Testament law, in Deuteronomy in particular, a number of laws were given to take care of them, to give them some ability to care for themselves. And this is where we get the laws regarding gleaning a field. So the basic idea is when you harvested a field, you know, you're going for the bulk of it. You got, you know, get the major stalks of grain and you're working it and you're getting through. Take it all to the threshing floor where later it'd be threshed. But inevitably, you miss stuff. There was stuff still in the field that you didn't get. And many a shrewd field owner would probably send his workers back out there and say, okay, you got some time off. I don't want you being lazy. Get back out there and go get all the little scraps that you left behind. God made that illegal in the law. Essentially, he said, you are not allowed to go back and get those scraps. You're not allowed to go back and glean your own field. You're going to leave it there so that the sojourner, the widow, the orphan, they can go and glean from your field. They can get those gleanings, those left behinds, to provide for themselves. And that was the intent. And it's really beautiful when you think about it. You know, we kind of live in a welfare state where if you have trouble, it's just they hand it to you, you know. But here there was a mix. You, if they were obeying the law, those who fell in unfortunate circumstances had the opportunity to provide for themselves in some sense. And in addition to this, there were other laws. There were periodic festivals where an extra tithe was supposed to be pulled apart for the Levite and also for the sojourner, the widow, and the orphan. And so there were extra blessings they were supposed to give. We don't have an indication that that actually happened very often, though. And so they would go and they would work in the fields behind the main reapers, behind the hired workers, in order to provide for themselves. And this would have been, it would have been a lowly rank, but at least it allowed them to get some opportunity to eat. Without this, there's nothing. And even as we read this narrative and we look at the situation with Ruth and Naomi, Naomi appears to be past an age where she can even do this. And not having sons, she's in a desperate situation. If it was not for her having Ruth with her, who could go out and glean from the fields, she would have been in a rough spot. It would have had, the last thing left would have been begging, which was typically reserved for those who had physical limitations that prevented them from working and gleaning in the fields. But what's the reason? And it's neat if we look at this passage in Deuteronomy 24 where he gives this command that I explained to you regarding not gleaning the fields but saving it. The ultimate reason he gives is, and you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I'm commanding you to do these things. Essentially saying, you were all in this type of situation once if you go back to your roots. You came from a poor, destitute situation, so you should have mercy on those who are likewise in a poor, destitute situation. And I can't help but just think of the New Testament parallel there, that we were all sinners, corrupt, in need of forgiveness, and how even we need to then be able to extend our own forgiveness to one another. It's the based upon our situation that we came from and that we're redeemed from is how we are to treat others. But of course, even in the New Testament, the command to provide for and care for our orphans and widows, as we see in James and likewise, it's still there. There's still the call to care for others. And even the early churches, we can see that they had an organized way of taking care of those who had no other means, meaning those that didn't even have family members to provide for them, the church would take care of. But if they had family members, they were responsible. It's very clear about that as well. Now, as we look at the way now these laws of gleaning the field were actually applied, and if we look at Ruth closely, we can see a few things about it. We can see, first of all, that obedience to this law that God gave to not glean the fields, but to save it for the those in poor situations, was not very consistently kept. We see this in a couple of places. First of all, in Ruth, the problem with bringing a digital Bible is it shuts off on you randomly. Not very helpful. In Ruth chapter 2, verse 2, Ruth says, "You know, please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one whom I may find favor in his eyes." She recognizes that for her to have any success gleaning, she's going to have to find favor in a landowner's eyes. It's not going to be the normal. It would be the exception to find a field where they're going to look at her favorably and allow her to do that. Secondly, we see even Boaz, you know, when he sees her and she sees the need, he tells her, don't go anywhere else. You know, anywhere else, he realizes and recognizes other fields, other landowners may not be receptive or hospitable to her. And so he did not want her going into any of those other fields where she may not be treated properly. Might be harassed by young men, might be chased away. This was not a normal thing for this to be obeyed. But what I love about Boaz's character as we read this narrative is to see that his obedience was assumed by all who knew him. So if we look at the narrative in verses 6 through 7, Boaz comes in and he asks his workers, one of the workers in charge, who is this woman? You know, what is she? And the man tells him, oh, she came, she asked if she could glean, and she's been doing it ever since. So even though Boaz was the landowner, the worker didn't even have to go and ask him if it was okay for her to be gleaning, because he knew Boaz would be okay with it. He knew Boaz's character was such that, of course, he's going to allow a widow to glean in his fields. No one had to ask, even though in other fields she may have very well been chased away. But, of course, Boaz even goes beyond the simple the requirements of the law. We see in his character one who doesn't just look to the exact letter of the law, but he goes beyond it to really live the spirit that God intended in the law, and to even have the love for the widow and the orphan that God has for them. And he goes beyond what the law required in telling his workers to leave extra grain behind and to even provide for her water and a meal while she's with them. And recognizing that she has no protection, he puts his protection over her while she's in the field and instructs his men to stay away and to stay near the women. So he gives an extra care and concern for her, which went beyond the minimum required, which really just manifests the spirit of the law that God gave and God's intention for it. He was not a Pharisee who was counting out the exact prescription of his tithe. Rather, he was a man who had imbibed the law, knew God, knew his character, and lived it. And that's really the kind of man that we see in Boaz. And we see that exemplified through this this gleaning law and the way he followed it and went above and beyond when even some of his other countrymen likely were not even obeying that command. Don't remember why I put these here. But just same idea here in the New Testament that how are we to treat one another? And, you know, I like Galatians 6, 8 through 10, just the idea of sowing. You know, you're looking at Ruth, they're sowing, they're reaping. And we see the same thing in the way we treat one another and the way we even give up of what we have in earthly things to reap an eternal reward. And we see Boaz exemplifying that type of spirit that we even know that we are to likewise exemplify in the New Testament age. Are we doing on time here? All right, kinsman redeemer. So this is probably one of the more confusing aspects of the book of Ruth. We have this idea of this kinsman redeemer. So Naomi finds out that she's been in this field of Boaz. He's been taking care of her, and she's excited for her. She says, yes, this man is a relative. He is one of our kinsman redeemers. And so what is this? What are we talking about when we say kinsman redeemer? So really what it is, it's a close relative to start with, who could offer in times of affliction and need really legal and financial support to their close relatives and actually stand in for them in their inability to stand in. So one of the... There's really several places where we see this relative, this redeemer, where they were supposed to function in the society according to the law. One would be redeeming something that's been sold. So if you came in economic hardship, you might sell your land, you might sell your possessions, you might sell yourself and your family into slavery because you have to, because you can no longer provide food and bread and eat. That kinsman redeemer could actually then pay the price to redeem you back into freedom or your goods or your land. But of course, nothing in Israel could be sold indefinitely. Nothing could be sold permanently. Well, a house in a walled city could, but that's a little different. But the land could not, a person could not, because as God says, they belong to me. The people of Israel were his. The land was his. And so these things could not be sold permanently. And so that was where... You might be familiar with the year of Jubilee. Every 50 years, Jubilee was to occur, and everything was to be released and sent back to the original owners, the original families. So you, if this worked properly, you could trace back to when the original inheritance was given out, when the tribes came in and Joshua split it up, and they from that point, they had their family allotments, and they passed it on from firstborn to firstborn. Those family allotments were supposed to stay. And this would prevent, huge social inequity in the sense that you wouldn't have just a few people owning all the land and then a massive amount of people unable to own any land. Because even if you fell into economic hardship, eventually that land would be restored to your family. And you'd get a new chance, new opportunity. However, as is the situation here, if there was no heir to pass on and to inherit that, that's where things ran into trouble. And that's where we have to get this idea of levirate marriage to then produce an heir who could continue that name and continue that allotment of land under their name. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But another area we see the kinsman redeemer is avenging death. So again, I said kinsman redeemer kind of fills in where the individual does not have the capacity to now. Well, you're dead. You can't avenge yourself. And so that was the kinsman redeemer's job to do that. Just like if you're now sold into slavery, you may not be able to redeem yourself. You might be able to. But you could have the kinsman redeemer as well. But also the kinsman redeemer would be able to produce offspring for the dead relative. And this is then if a man dies without any sons or children or any offspring to continue his name, the closest brother was then to go into his wife to produce offspring for him, to give a child. Now, this is something that for us in our day of thinking, we really struggle with. We're like, well, that isn't, how is that not adultery? And, it's a very confusing topic for us, but we also got to remember that... having a child for the woman was her life savings. That was her retirement. That was her ability to survive. And so not having offspring, even just for her, was going to be very detrimental. And then additionally, just the significance and the importance of a name being passed down. in ancient times, the idea of having no descendants and being blotted out was worse than dying, because of course you're going to die eventually. But to die without a descendant, without your name being perpetuated, was kind of the worst thing that could happen. And it actually predates the law. As we read about the command in Deuteronomy for this levirate marriage, as it's called, for this kinsman to produce offspring, God did not make it up in Deuteronomy. It wasn't a new thing. It had already existed. He was simply adding further legislation to it, adding further requirements for it, and giving a punishment of public humiliation for the one who does not perform that duty. But the other example we have of this happening, of course, is with Judah and Tamar, if you all are familiar with that story. It's one that if you're doing, you know, reading the Bible with your kids, you skip that chapter because it's horrifying. but in it, you kind of see some of the tension with being a kinsman redeemer. So you had the firstborn who died. Now, the firstborn would have the inheritance rights of the land and the possessions. He would have the greater possession, the birthright. And so he dies, and Judah tells his other son, all right, you go into his wife to produce offspring for him. Essentially what he's saying is, you're not taking his spot. You're not getting the double portion. You're going to produce a child for him who's going to get it. You're still secondborn. But this child is going to be your brother's child, and he's going to take that inheritance, not your child. That's what it means. So the kinsman redeemer couldn't be selfish. And in that case, Onan was selfish. He did not want to produce an heir for his brother, and did not. And God killed him for his wickedness. And then, of course, the story takes a crazy turn, but it is also interesting in Ruth that they, at the end of Ruth, they compare Ruth to Tamar and the blessing of what came through her, and even providing for that line.
Sorry, did you say Odin a minute ago when you were referencing
Onan?
The guy who
didn't
do
Onan?
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's O-N-A-N. Yeah, Onan. Sorry, did I say Odin? Odin's son, father of Thor. Yeah, there we go. Not quite there yet. So then when we look at the narrative, when we look at Ruth, and we recognize that this wasn't something desirable to do in most situations. Like, it wasn't to your personal gain to produce an heir. And especially in this story, it was not. If you're familiar with the story, when Boaz goes to the closer kinsman redeemer, the one who had first dibs and first rights, he says, there's land to be redeemed. So we don't know what this... Most likely, Elimelech had sold the land before he left. And he probably sold it dirt cheap because there was a famine. You know, it was worthless. And now coming back, that land could be redeemed by a kinsman redeemer. And this closer redeemer, here's the land, good price, and best part about it is after Jubilee, it stays with me because Elimelech had no heirs. And so my sons, my descendants get to keep this land because he has no heirs. And so I'm not just buying it until the next Jubilee, which was normal in Israel. You just kind of leased land. He was going to get it in forever, in a sense, without heirs. And so he's very enthusiastic. Yeah, I'll buy it. I'll take it. Absolutely. I want to redeem it. And then Boaz adds the other thing. Oh, but in the day you acquire it, you also acquire the wife of the deceased, Ruth the Moabite. And he changes his tune very quickly. Because if that is the case, then this child that he gives Ruth is going to inherit that land and take that land. And it is going to affect his own rights. And not only that, but he's going to have to feed her the whole time. You know, you got to remember, it was expensive to feed mouths. You know, I generally believe that's one of the reasons they tended to marry off women younger. Is simply the father's like, I'm done feeding you. Get married. He can feed you. because it was hard work, it was expensive to feed people, and it was a huge burden on them on a regular basis. And so once it became an act of selflessness, the other Redeemer wanted nothing to do it. He was very selfish. He was like, that would not work well for me. That's not what I'm going for. And of course, like God often does, his name is excluded from Scripture. He doesn't get his name actually handed down in any significant way. Whereas in Boaz, of course, we know his name because he selflessly was willing to take on that burden and to provide. And so we get this picture here now of providing this heir. The line does not die out. And even Naomi herself now having a child, a grandchild from this union, she has someone to provide for her, to care for her, to love her. And we see that that he exemplifies that Redeemer. Now, hopefully we got time here. This is where I plan on spending the most of my time, actually, but I did not apparently space that out very well. As I mentioned earlier, there is this prohibition in Deuteronomy, this command not to allow an Ammonite or a Moabite to enter the assembly of Yahweh to the 10th generation. Even to the extent of verse 6, you shall never seek their peace or their prosperity all your days. And this is all based... Well, if we remember the history of Moab, where did Moab come from? Yeah, so it didn't start off great. Yeah. So you got Lot and his daughters, and that produced the Ammonites and the Moabites. But it's not all bad. God promised them and gave them a lot of land that was to be theirs. So when the Israelites are coming through, he commands Israel, don't touch them. I'm not giving you their land. I've promised it to Lot and his descendants. You can't have it. But nonetheless, they're not friendly. And they don't provide the food, the water. And instead, they hire Balaam, son of Beor, to come out and try to curse them. It fails. And when that doesn't work, they send their women out to corrupt them. And they send their women to come in and marry them and bring their gods with them. And that's quite successful until I think Phinehas has to put a spear through the belly to stop God's rage in that situation. So there's a lot of bad interactions between Israel and Moab in particular that cause this curse, this prohibition. And so the question then we have to deal with is this creates tension for us. If you're aware of this law, then when you get to Ruth, you got to start scratching your head. And that's not a bad thing. I find most apparent paradoxes in the Bible end up becoming kind of some of the most beautiful places to find precise truth. You know, even just recognizing how can we be condemned by God and yet saved as sinners. Like, it's almost a paradox until you realize that he would actually be propitiation, stand in for us. There's these places of the Scripture where it doesn't seem to make sense at first, but when you finally find that razor's edge that explains it, it just perfectly brings it together. And this is one of those difficult passages that have kind of been on my hobby horse for years. And part of the reason I decided to teach this today is I'm like, I want to actually sit down and figure this out. How is it that Ruth was able to not only be married by Boaz, but he had no qualms with it. And clearly God had no concern with it because he then blessed that union and through it he brought the king and the messianic line. And the book of Ruth is very clear that she's a Moabite. You know, they want you to know it. It keeps telling you over and over and over, the Moabite, the Moabite, the Moabite. You can't avoid it. There is this tension being created by the author here. So that brings the question, how is this resolved? How do we resolve this tension? And again, this is one of those things that you just have to wrestle with over a long time. Or maybe hear my answer and take it or leave it. I thought I'd put this. So one of the earlier views that some rabbis propose. I think this is dead wrong, but they simply, to make amends and to ease this tension, they said, well, the curse against the moat was only against the men. It was the men who didn't provide food and water, and so it was okay to bring a Moabite woman into the assembly, just not a man. The problem with that interpretation is if we look later in the book of Ezra, great Bible teacher, he knew the word, he knew the law. When he found out that the locals were marrying foreign women, they decided that the obedience to the law was to put them out, them and their children. And what this means is their children would have no inheritance rights. They got rid of their foreign wives and their children, leaving them with no inheritance rights because they were not permitted. So how then, if Ezra, in interpreting the law, concludes that they must be put out with no inheritance rights, is Ruth brought in with full inheritance rights and in the line of Messiah? So another way to think it through, I don't think this one's right either, but is just to consider the priorities of the law and to say that perhaps, well, yes, she was a Moabite, but there's also all the law about taking care of the widows and the sojourners, and she is those. And so perhaps it was just simply the greater law as opposed to the lesser laws balancing out. But let's not forget, cursed is he who does not confirm the words of the law by doing them, by doing all of it, all the law. Paul talks about this. You're cursed if you don't do the whole law. And, of course, that's kind of the point. You can't do the whole law. And so, through the law, you are only found to be cursed. And I think that kind of brings us to the answer. If the law never saved anybody, if everyone at some point becomes cursed by the law, by their disobedience, by being a Moabite, by being what, then what is the answer? What predates the law? As Paul would tell us.
I think that part of it is Ruth showing her faithfulness and belief in true Yahweh God. I mean, we see that
faith.
In the fact that she followed Naomi. Faith that she believed in the true God.
Absolutely, because that predates the law. That's Abraham, isn't it? Abraham believed in God. It was counted to him as righteousness. And that faith supersedes the curse of the law. And as we know from Paul, the law produces a curse for everyone who attempts to follow it. And so it is only through faith that we can be freed from that curse. And I believe that Boaz recognized that, and Boaz saw that she was a woman of faith, and that faith would trump the condemnation that was under the law. And we see her faith so beautifully exemplified in the book. It's hidden at first reading, perhaps, but when you look closely, you see she clearly had attached herself to Yahweh and to believing in God and trusting in Him and living a life that confirmed her faithfulness. Let's see, I've got to try to speed this up here a little bit. So just to make a counterpoint here a little bit with Ezra and his call to have the people put away their foreign wives, he recognized that those foreign wives were going to, they were committing abominations and they were going to lead the people's heart astray. Those foreign wives were still foreign wives. They remained foreigners to God's covenant. They remained foreigners to God's promises. Just because they were married did not make them Israelites. It did not make them obedient to the law. Ruth, on the other hand, in a very real way, ceased to be a foreigner and became a true servant, follower of God. And she was not going to be one who would, she wasn't going to tempt Boaz to follow idols, to follow other gods. And instead, she was going to be, actually she's called an excellent woman, the same verbiage, the same description that is used of the woman in Proverbs 31 is the description given to her. But let me just look real quickly with you, just show you some of the places where we see her faith exemplified in the book. We see it here in Ruth 1, 8 through 10. Naomi's leaving. She turns back. She tells both her daughters-in-law, go home. I have nothing for you. There is nothing that I can provide for you, nothing I can give you. Go back to your mother's house. Let your parents take care of you and find new husbands for you so you can be provided for. Because where I'm going, I have nothing for you. Go back to your gods. And they both have a strong emotional connection to Naomi. They both love her. They both are emotionally connected. The difference is, when it comes to ultimately giving up one's life to move forward, knowing that there is nothing for you, knowing that you're giving up everything you have, for Orpah, there was no faith to back up that emotion that she had. We kind of see a parallel with true and false professions here. She had the same emotional reaction as Ruth, but ultimately she went back to what she knew, what she could trust in, which was not God. Ruth, on the other hand, had faith in Yahweh where she was going, and she went with her, and she was willing to, made her appeal to Yahweh, in fact, to take Naomi's God as her own God. Thus may Yahweh do to me and more if anything but death separates you and me. And so her appeal, she is very much showing herself as a follower of Israel's God, of Yahweh, and not depending on anything but him. Furthermore, this is probably my favorite one. This is Boaz speaking to her. He recognizes, he's talked to people. They've seen the way she's behaving. They've seen the way she's caring for her mother-in-law. And so he tells her, he says, may Yahweh fully repay your work, and may your wages be full from Yahweh, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. That's really a beautiful picture of faith, of coming under God's protection, of trusting in him for the outcomes, trusting in him for her protection. I also love the fact that when you kind of look at this phrase of coming under the wings, you see it about 6 times in the Psalms, and 5 of them are all Davidic Psalms. And the 6th one was probably influenced by Davidic Psalms. And then you realize Boaz is the great-grandfather of David. And you almost just see kind of like a family tradition of faithfulness, of even just David using the same kind of language, way of referring to faith that Boaz does here. And you just see kind of that family tradition a little bit and what Boaz and his faithfulness was able to provide such security and such faithfulness to Yahweh that it passed down generations and extended to David. But we certainly see, we see the Psalms of David where he uses the same type of verbiage to describe having faith. And so Naomi, Ruth was a woman of faith. She believed just like Abraham did. She believed in God, trusted in his promises. And that, like for any of us, God, Christ, was able to take away the curse that she was under. But ultimately, we're all under a curse. We're all under the curse from sin, from the garden. And when we see this picture, we see almost an expression of going from the lesser to the greater. If God could not accomplish overcoming this lesser curse, then how could he save us from the greater curse that we have, that we found in the garden, that we are all under as a result of sin? And by overcoming the curse here for Ruth in her faith, that extends hope of the full curse of God being able to save anyone from whatever situation, whatever curse, whatever sin that prevents us from getting his salvation, can overcome all of that through faith. Apologize, I went long. Let's pray.